Greetings, dear listeners, and welcome to a special edition of Real Skiers with Jackson Hogan. What makes it special is my guest today, none other than the legend himself, Mr. Wayne Wong. I don't use the term legend lightly. In fact, Wayne's nickname on the Snow Country Magazine test team was The Legend, or just Ledge. Wayne Wong earned legend status by being the most high-profile athlete at a magical time in skiing's history, the arrival of hot dog skiing that burst on the American ski scene in the early 1970s. Freestyle skiing, the more normal term for hot dog skiing once competitions began handing out cash, cars, and championship trophies the size of a moose head, it quickly distilled into three events: moguls, aerials, and ballet. Ballet is no longer with us, but at the time, its emphasis on tricks and off-the-wall moves made it the embodiment of the freestyle movement. Hard as it might be to believe today, some of the freestyle tour's brightest stars were masters of ballet, including overall champions like John Clendenin and Scott Brooksbank, and marquee quality personalities like Wild Bill O'Leary and Troy Caldwell. But nobody captured the spirit of the freestyle movement like Wayne Wong. His signature moves, like the Wong Banger, were featured in ski flicks that became cult classics. He didn't earn the avalanche of titles that some of his peers managed to amass, but he earned greater notoriety as brand ambassador for ski outfits like K2 and Salomon, although a lot of athletes had equipment deals, and much more significantly, non-ski brands like Pepsi and Dodge. I don't know if anyone has ever tabulated earnings from that era, but I'll bet you Wayne Wong was skiing's version of Arnold Palmer. He was a magnet for media who raised the level of his sport just by showing up. He also happens to be one of the nicest, kindest, most gentlemanly persons you'll ever meet. We'll talk with Wayne about his accomplishments, two of which I'll mention here. He's a class of 2013 member of the U.S. Ski and Snowboard Hall of Fame, in part because in the watershed year of 1972, Wayne was Skiing Magazine's Freestyle Skier of the Year, a very big deal back in the day. Wayne Wong, it gives me infinite pleasure to welcome you to Real Skiers with Jackson Hogan.
Hey, thanks, Jackson. It's great to hear from you and talk with you again.
Before you became probably the most recognized skier in the world, you grew up in Vancouver, British Columbia. Where did you first ski, and how did you evolve from citizen skier to freestyle competitor?
So I grew up in Vancouver. I started skiing in 1961 at the age of 11, and I joined a Burnaby Parks and Recreation ski program for 8 weeks. They would take you by bus up to Mount Seymour, which is one of the local ski areas right outside of downtown Vancouver. It would only take about, you know, half an hour, 45 minutes to get up, being Grouse Mountain and Seymour side by side at that time. So I joined, took the 8 week ski lessons, and the first day on the snow, I was hooked. I mean, it was the most incredible thing. You know, I had been encouraged by a fellow classmate in the seventh grade that would go skiing every weekend with his family down to Mount Baker, Washington. And he'd come back with all his, you know, nice glow suntan and just raving about how much fun they had. And he said, "Hey, Wayne, you ought to try that." So I said, "Yeah, I might try that." So I asked my mom and dad if I could do that. Man, that was the start of it all for me.
What was your breakout event?
So, okay, let's back up just a little bit. The ski area that I learned to ski on wasn't that big. There wasn't a lot of vertical, and there wasn't really a lot of challenging terrain. We had rope toes, and we had T-bar, pommel lift. So what happened to me was, in order to challenge my skiing skills, at that time, in the mid-60s, I would suppose, Hart Ski Company came out with a bunch of great movies like The Mobius Flip, The Incredible Skis, Ski the Outer Limits. And there were guys in those movies that were doing tricks on their skis. And I was absolutely enthralled by that. I go, wow, that is pretty cool. Being on this local hill with good terrain for that kind of stuff, I started trying some of the stuff that I had seen in the movies. We didn't have anybody to coach us or anything. I would accidentally fall, spin around, turn around, and I go, wow, that was pretty cool. Maybe I'll name that a trick after me. So I started to build up a repertoire of tricks over the next few years that some of the tricks, like the Wong Banger and the Wong Mill, you know, namesake maneuvers, I know nobody had ever seen before. As I was building up this repertoire, you know, I became known as the local hot dogger. It was in 1971 when I saw the ad in Skiing Magazine to come back to Waterville Valley, New Hampshire, and test my skills and see who was the best skier on the mountain? Was it the guys skiing bumps? Was it the racers? Was it guys doing aerials? Were the guys doing tricks on skis? And all my friends and local ski instructor buddies all convinced me that I should go back and do that. So that was in March of 1971, which was the very first professional freestyle championships of exhibition skiing.
Just to pause for a moment. So you were looking at films of people like Art Fuhrer, for example, doing the javelin turn, maybe Tommy Leroy.
Yeah, Tommy Leroy, Rudy Wersch, Easy Chapstick, of course. I think probably the guy that most influenced me the most was Art Fuhrer, because he could do more tricks than anybody else on that demo team. I love watching him, and I studied him and studied the moves that he did. He started doing World Christies and crossovers and javelin turns and outriggers and those sort of what we call basic tricks at that time. I would accidentally cross my ski and spin around again, and bang, there's another new trick. So not only for me, but I think a lot of the other guys that I ended up competing with started developing their skills and tricks that nobody had ever seen before. So once we had an arena to display all these maneuvers, it was amazing because nobody had seen it, and it caught the attention of the mainstream America.
So take us back to Waterville Valley then. It was a full-on three-event freestyle open, something like that. Did you have to qualify?
Okay, so we'll go back to that because that's a really interesting piece of history, Jackson. The first event, I'll tell you how that all came about. Tommy Corcoran, who had just come off the U.S. ski team and developed Waterville Valley, was in a ski dinner with Doug Pfeiffer from Skiing Magazine. And they had this conversation as to who the best skier might be on the mountain. Well, Tommy, being an alpine ski racer, said, well, you know, it's obvious. It's got to be the ski racers. Doug Pfeiffer, who was instrumental in PSIA and editor-in-chief of Skiing Magazine, was a little bit of a rebel. And he said, Tommy, I beg to differ with you. What about the guys that are doing jumps? What about the mogul skiers? What about the guys that are doing tricks on skis? Why don't you put your money where your mouth is, and let's have a competition at your new ski area, Waterville Valley. So they were able to put together the first event and brought Chevrolet in as the sponsor, title sponsor. And the event was called, at that time, was called the National Championships of Exhibition Skiing. And it was on a run called True Grit. It's a very steep, moguly, long, a perfect run to display all these things. The top part was very steep and bumpy, and the middle section had a bunch of rolls, and then in the bottom section, it just kind of rolled out to a nice flat area. The format at that time was the best 2 out of 3 runs to count for your scores. They would take out your lowest score and just keep your 2 highest scores.
Dear listeners, understand that if you give a competitor who's going to do a hell-bent for leather exercise a chance to have a throwaway run, you're going to see some amazing runs.
Well, thank God we had that, because for me, yeah, we'll go back into a little bit of the history. So one of the tricks that I invented back home was the Wong Banger, which is actually a pole flip with your ski poles without a jump. And I accidentally learned this by running into a very steep transition and my ski tip stuck. And instinctively, I stuck my poles out in front of me and did a vault and flipped right over and landed back on my feet again. So this is one of the tricks I had up my sleeve. And I go, okay, I'm going to go back to Waterville Valley. I'm going to unleash the Wong Banger to the world. The first run, I got into starting gate and I'm thinking, okay, 3 moguls down from the start, I'm going to throw the Wong Banger. And I go, okay. So I start off, and when it was my turn, there was 45 competitors or so at that event. And some of them were from the Hart demo team, including Susie Chaffee and Herman Goldner. Anyways, I planned my run out. And on the third mogul, I sucked my poles in to do a flip, and I absolutely missed it. Wiped out, missed it. And here I'm sitting on the ground, and I'm looking and talking to myself. I came 3,000 miles to fall on the third mogul. That really sucked. I continued on, and after the first run, I was somewhere in the middle of the pack. And then on the second run, everything went a little bit better. And I actually was tied for third place. And then on the third and final run, I was skiing down and I skied really well down through the mogul section. And then in the middle area where they had the big bumps and rolls, big jumps and rolls, I was taken off of one of these and I pre-released out of a binding. And I left one ski on the top of this knoll. And now I'm 20 feet in the air with one ski. And I land perfectly on the one ski. And I do all these 360s and spins all the way down through the finish gate. Everybody goes, how'd you do that, Wade? How'd you plant? How were you able to get your ski to release? So that was by mistake, but that gave me some notoriety to be able to pull that off as well. I ended up taking third place overall. Herman Golder from Stratton Mountain and the Austrian ski team actually won the event and took home a Chevy Corvette.
Dear listeners, Herman Golder may not be a name that comes top of mind to you, but he was an extraordinary athlete, and he made a gainer, a full laid out backflip, look as easy as stepping off the sidewalk.
Yeah, I would ask your listeners to go and check out a couple movies, the Incredible Skis by Hart, and also Ski the Outer Limits and the Mobius Slip. So Herman was first guy ever that I saw do a full twisting back somersault. And they called that the Mobius Slip, and they did a whole promotional movie around that. Not only that, Tommy Leroy and Herman are doing front and back flips in the Corbett's Cool War at Jackson Hole. This was very inspirational stuff to me way back before I started. So that's a little background about Herman Golder and Tommy Leroy, who were members of the Hart demo team at that time. One other side note, Jean-Claude Keeley was the head judge at this event. How many kids would ever get a chance to ski with an Olympic champion and a hero? And I got to meet him and talk with him a little bit. You know, I'm a 21-year-old kid from Vancouver, British Columbia. And here's this international Olympic skiing champion. And I'm walking in the same day lodge and hanging out with him too. So it was just the most phenomenal thing.
Now, there was a series of so-called championship events that winter, of which Waterville Valley was the first, but didn't we have a Rocky Mountain location?
Yes. So the first event was in the beginning of March of 1971, and it went so well, and it was so well received, and Chevrolet wanted to back another event. So they were able to pull another one off within 4 weeks at Vail. And unfortunately, I wasn't able to attend the one at Vail. It happened during the time of Interski, which is where all the ski instructor congresses of the world come and exchange teaching technique and ideas. Fritzie Garhammer, who was part of the German demo team, because he was there and he was a very talented skier, entered the event and actually won it. So Fritzie became a part of the history of the freestyle movement. He and his brothers and a couple of other Europeans got involved later on. But that's what happened. That spring of 1971, there was two events, one at Waterville and one at Vail.
So the following year, Doug Pfeiffer would put his money where his mouth was and have a skiing magazine, Freestyle Skier of the Year. You ended up, I don't know if there's really a vote tally given, but I don't think there was anybody contesting your being named that champion, given that sort of fictive championship, if you will. How did you outshine the competition at a time when there was some incredible athletes just discovering freestyle skiing?
Okay, we'll back up a little bit. At Waterville, it became very evident that there was really kind of three disciplines that evolved, because there were guys that could ski moguls really well and couldn't do anything else. There were guys that could do aerials really well but couldn't ski. And there were guys that could do tricks that couldn't do everything well. So it was really kind of a cool deal to see it at that early stage be divided up into the three disciplines that we know: ballet skiing, mogul skiing, and aerial acrobatics. What happened was the following year, Doug Pfeiffer and skiing got on board and they produced three events, one at Waterville, one at Sun Valley.
Sun Valley. Yeah.
And one at Vail. That year, I took a second combined at Waterville. I took a third combined at Sun Valley, and I took a second combined at Vail. And unbeknownst to me or any of the athletes at that time, they came out with this presentation of the Freestyle Skier of the Year. And it was a surprise to me when they awarded that to me. I was looking at that trophy sitting on top of the car that they're giving away. I was more excited about the trophy. It's a huge trophy. And actually, that event, Scotty Brooksbank won it. But I took home the Freestyle Skier of the Year award.
That, in my estimation, turned out to be more valuable than the car.
For me, it was, because it meant a lot. It meant a lot to me. The car, yeah, the car would have been cool, but to be acknowledged as the first ever Freestyle Skier of the Year, that was special, really special.
Where in this particular chronology are you fortunate enough to get the Pepsi Generation commercial?
Okay. My whole career has been a series of being in the right place at the right time. So that year, that spring, Doug Pfeiffer asked me to come to Mammoth Mountain and ski test for Skiing Magazine at Mammoth. So I was there for a month testing all the newest and latest, greatest stuff for the next season, which that was a dream come true too. How many guys ever get a chance to ski on 150 new skis for the next season? Anyhow, during that time while we were there, an ad agency came up from LA that wanted to shoot an ad. And they were just walking, this was in May, and they were walking through the base lodge, just telling everybody that they were there to do this commercial. If anybody wanted to ski in it, they should show up on chair 3 at 1 o'clock. So I had finished ski testing that morning, and my buddies and I decided, yeah, well, let's go up and do this. So what they said was, we'll pay you $50. And if we use you in the ad, then you'll get a royalty. And okay, cool. So I go up there with my guys. The other guys were just doing regular skiing. And I'm popping off these moguls. I'm sitting back on the tails of my ski. I'm coming down to the in front of the cameras. And I pull off a helicopter. And I ended up sitting back a little bit too much. But I threw it into an outrigger coming into the finish area. And that was kind of it. And I did, and they said, thanks, guys. And they gave us a check for cash or whatever it was for $50. And they said, well, we'll see if you get in the ad or not. And I didn't know that I made it off of the cutting room floor or not. That following fall, the fall of 1972, that ad was broadcast nationally starting like early October. And I didn't know I was going to make it. And my friend said, hey, Wayne, we just saw you on this Pepsi commercial. And it was about a month and a half later that I actually saw it. But the coolest part that everybody really remembers is me doing the helicopter into an outrigger turn and skiing through the Pepsi logo right at the finish of the commercial.
Exactly, ladies and gentlemen. The timing of the aerial, well, obviously very well edited, very professionally edited piece of work that captured this maneuver and made it sort of mask the recovery. You had to be a good freestyle skier yourself to know that there was a recovery involved here. But
well, we don't tell people there was a recovery.
It was
absolutely planned, Jackson.
smoothly segued from a heli into an outrigger. And your smile went ear to ear. Your shades. Who is your sunglass company?
You know, at that time, I really didn't have a sponsor, but CB were the ones that came out with the aviator frames, and they were advertising it all over. And Keeley was sponsored by them, and I just liked the looks of them. And they came out with the white ones. I said, "Oh, this is really cool. This would look great with my black hair and my suntan." And that really kind of became my trademark: my hair and the white sunglasses. About 3 years ago, a company from Europe approached me and said, hey, Wayne, we're rebooting the white aviator glasses, and we want to use you as our signature guy, and we want to do a Wayne Wong signature white sunglass. And the company is called Valen Eyewear out of Europe. So it's been really kind of fun to keep my name out there and to be able to still promote the white aviator sunglasses. They are available online.
Super. One thing I remember from that ad is a stark contrast with the day. Your wonderful shaggy mop of dark hair, no helmets. I think personality comes through better if you don't have a bucket on your head. And I think that really helped the magnetism, the warmth that you seem to radiate.
Funny part about that, Jackson, you know, back in the day there, nobody wore helmets, right? And it was long, long, long after my competition days were over that helmets started became mainstream. I fought it for the longest time, mainly because my hair really became kind of a signature piece. To hide it under a helmet was kind of, this is not good. But my daughter, family, they said, you know, Dad, you need to wear a helmet. And I finally realized that, yeah, I got to do it and I got to wear a helmet. One of the funny stories I have to tell you, I was in Montana skiing and I ski up to this guy, Warren Miller. And I'm talking to Warren for about 5 minutes and he's looking at me and I got my helmet, my glasses on. And he looks and he drops his chin. He looks underneath and he goes, Wayne Wong, is that you? I just laughed my guts out. So even with a helmet on, people were still able to recognize me. Especially Warren Miller. Come on, man.
Back in the day, ski shops would get these promotional videos from brands like K2 and Salomon that you were sponsored by. The technology mercifully died, but they'd have these larger-than-life cassettes that you'd shove into this sort of rickety-looking TV screen. And we wore that machine out at the Maverick Breckenridge, watching you and Mike shave. The first time I ever saw a Shea Guy routine. And I was a budding freestyle skier myself. I was trying to learn from you, just as you had tried to learn from Art Fuhrer. And there was a seminal bump run, totally playful, done by you and Clendenin. It was totally in the spirit of freestyle. It wasn't an event. You were just having fun ripping down this bump run. Do you remember that particular video segment?
I do remember skiing with Clendenin and shooting some stuff and with Jean-Claude Keeley and the K2 demo team. I know what you're talking about, those Salomon cassette things or whatever. And Salomon produced a couple of movies called Go For It. I forgot the name of the other ones, but those were played over and over and over. And that featured all of us that were sponsored by Salomon because of what we were doing. And nobody really had seen that kind of stuff before. People wanted to watch it over and over and over again. And thus, those cassette machines got burned out.
They sure did. The first time I met you that I recall vividly, because I was meeting a legend, wasn't really so much a meeting as just your arrival at the start gate of the mogul qualifying for the Bacanta Cup in Park City. And this was like a $35,000 purse for, you know, anybody that showed up that could pass the qualification. The trick was you would only qualify in one event, but if you got in, you would compete in all three. So you picked your best event, which for me was moguls, and then you hoped you got in, and then you'd be able to show your entire routine off. You showed up at the start. You were wearing a big fur hat. I mean, it was like the size of your head doubled. It seemed like to me. And you said, Wong's the name, freestyle's the game. And a big, huge smile on that incandescent smile that only you can produce. It just lit up the whole start area, which was very tense because a lot of people up there like me were uncertain of the outcome of all this stuff. And others were more experienced at it. Do you remember the Bacanta Cup?
Yes, absolutely. Yep. Actually, Robert Redford was the head judge at that event.
Wonderful. I remember Stein foreran it flawlessly.
Yeah.
Keep in mind also, ladies and gentlemen, this is at a time when it was very hard to stay in one's bindings because binding technology at the time, frankly, sucked. I was still waiting for Georges Salomon to come through and a promise to send me the new 555s, which you couldn't get yet. And I was still on a 505, which came off just looking at it. But those weren't the only bindings that came off just looking at them. The Besser plate binding, which you had to use if Dynastar sponsored you, it would come off on the takeoff. Wonderful feature. So I just want you to understand that people were going hell-bent for leather at all three of these events in equipment that by any modern standard was awful.
Yeah, you know, I met Airborne Eddie Ferguson and Scotty Brooksbank were sponsored by Besser and Dynastar at that time, and they kept blowing out other binding all the time, that Besser binding. Unfortunately.
As I mentioned a moment ago, the best ballet skiers were rock stars at the start of this whole era. And skiers like Mark Stiegemeyer and Lane Spina and Bob Howard would later continue the tradition of ballet, which got rechristened Acro at one point in time. But eventually all the air came out of that balloon. Well, what killed ballet skiing?
Part of it was the FIS would not recognize it because they said, we do not want another event that is judged and be so
subjective.
Subjective, yes, like figure skating. So until you can actually figure out a format where they could actually look at different maneuvers or whatever and score it, then they said, we don't want anything to do with it. Although the athletes that were doing the acro, oh my gosh, they took it to the next level. You know, like they took my wong banger and started doing full double twisting front somersaults over their poles, the daffy spins and all that kind of stuff. Really were magnificent maneuvers. I think part of it too was we had reached a saturation point as far as new maneuvers. So the athletes weren't really coming out with a lot of innovative new maneuvers like we were doing in the early part of the freestyle. And so when you went to a competition 10 years, 12, 15 years later, most of the routines were basically the same maneuvers, but maybe in a different sequence. I think it lost a lot of its spark at that time because of that, because when we were competing, you went to watch the event and you could expect to see the unexpected. That's what you were there for. You wanted to see somebody throw something you've never seen before. Later on, there was guys throwing great stuff. I mean, double twisting front pole flips became mundane. It became an everyday deal. So it really, I think personally, it lost a little bit of its sparkle, although the athletes themselves were well honed at their craft.
Speaking of showing your craft around, at the time, skiing seemed like a bigger deal. It may not have had more participants, but we had more share of mind, I think, in national media. It was sexy. And you helped contribute to that by putting your personality out on the road. You went to Harry Leonard consumer shows. What other things did you do to try to keep the fire burning, if you will, amongst real skiers?
I toured with the Harry Leonard consumer shows for about 3 years in the fall. And we'd go from city to city. It was like a rock and roll show from San Francisco all the way out to New York with stops in Chicago, Detroit, et cetera, on the way. And we performed on the ski deck. And there was a chance where everyday public guy could come up and meet us that didn't have to go out on the ski slope. And we'd be there performing some of the tricks that we would do on snow. And then afterwards, you know, go and sign autographs and talk with the public and get them all excited about skiing. And then they'd go out and try to do the same thing as I did, try to learn some of these tricks on their own. I was very fortunate to be able to be sponsored by these different companies that took me to different ski shops all around the country and different ski shows. So in the fall, starting like Labor Day weekend, I'd be in Charlotte, North Carolina, or I'd be in Dallas, Texas, or I'd be up in Detroit, spending time in ski shops and just talking with kids that wanted to meet me and talk about freestyle skiing and share our love and passion for the sport. Doing that for many years, I realized that at that time, as the sport was progressing, I was spending more of my time on the road doing those types of things, those shows, where my fellow competitors were out there training and really working on their skills for the following season. At some point, I realized that, you know, I can't stay competitive if I'm spending half of my year in ski shop and halls and that sort of thing. And I said to myself, you know, I competed for 6 or 7 years. I did what I wanted to do. I wanted to show people what they could do on skis and how much fun it would be. The competition part of it for me really just kind of faded away, and I just needed to move on to other things within the skiing industry.
It's an interesting time, though, by the mid-70s, because there is a break that's about to come in the American freestyle scene when a friend of mine from Copper Mountain named Scotty Magrino broke his back trying to pull out a double out of the end run was supposed to be a single flip on a sequence of jumps at Vail. And Peter Hirschhorn, another skier, had broke his back at a steamboat event 2 weeks earlier. Didn't take long for the insurance companies that were insuring the NSAA ski areas to realize that this could be a bit of a risky business if everyone starts taking inverted flips. So they more or less told their membership, which was basically every ski area in America minus one or two, that if they wanted to be insured, they couldn't allow inverted aerials in competition on their slope. What happened there, and what did you and your fellow competitors do about it at the time?
Good point, Jackson. Yeah, that became a defining moment in skiing, in freestyle skiing in the United States. But what happened was the Canadians' insurance companies were more lenient. So they were still allowing those maneuvers to happen, those aerials to happen. So the movement became strong in Canada because that was the only place, and in Europe were the only places where they could continue competing in freestyle skiing and producing freestyle events. As a result, there was a whole influx of really great Canadian athletes like John Eaves and the Bowie brothers and those guys who were all really, really great athletes. The movement moved from the United States and kind of quieted down because of the insurance thing and then moved into Canada and Europe. Today, I am absolutely blown away by seeing kids doing double flips in the terrain park or triple rodeos and all this kind of stuff that we would never have been allowed to do back in the mid-70s. And every day you're skiing along and some kid comes out of the backwoods, out of the side of the trail, doing a backflip or a rodeo back onto the main slope. You go, holy crap, what was that? Historically, what happened, there was a big movement to have freestyle accepted by the FIS. The Canadians and Johnny Johnson were a big part of that movement to get the IOC and the FIS to adopt freestyle skiing. As a result, in Albertville, ballet, I think, was a demo sport. It was not an actual medal sport, but mogul skiing and aerials were and continue to do so.
Interesting that freestyle skiing had to go to Europe to be saved. There was another event at which you competed, lesser known perhaps to the general public, but once you see them, you never forget them. And those are the Powder Eights. That was, I think, a Wrigley event. Was the one of the principal sponsors. Who were the sponsors for the Powder Eights? And how long did you compete, etc.?
The World Powder Eight Ski Championships were held at Mike Wrigley's Heli Ski Operation in British Columbia in the Cariboos. It was a very unique event, although I believe the year before they actually started, and I can't remember when they started, Jackson Hole hosted the first Powder Eight Championships in the United States. And I think it was the following year that Wrigley's hosted the World Powder Eight Championships there. They had done it for about 3 or 4 years. I guess it would have been early 1980s, late 70s. But I went to compete there. I was sponsored by a Japanese ski company called ASICS. Most people might know them from their footwear and athletic wear, but they're also a ski and boot distributor in Japan. And so they paired me with their top ski pro and said, we'd like for you guys to compete at the World Powder Eight Championships at Wrigley's. And it was, I believe that was 1984. We went there and we won it. I can't remember exactly how many competitors were, but there were guys from Europe. There was guys in the United States, Canada, but we were the only other real international team because I was representing Canada and Japan at that time. We were fortunate enough to win it. And then we were asked the next year to come back and compete, and we won it again. And then the following year, I had a hiatus. I couldn't go. And then I went the following year, and I think we ended up second. No, I won it three times. Sorry.
I got three over here.
Yeah. I was actually with my partner, three-time World Powder Eight Champions back in the day.
A couple of comments on that, dear listeners. One is the ASICS clothes that Wayne refers to are so brightly colored, they're visible from space. I have a picture that I'm going to include with this on my weekly podcast email of Wayne's at our Snow Country magazine test, about which we'll talk in a few minutes, in one of these ASICS outfits, and you'll see what I mean. Colorful doesn't really describe it.
You know, the cool thing about it is the Japanese are into the whole image thing, right? And so everything that they produced, they wanted to create an image like you'd never seen here in the United States. So I was very fortunate to be sponsored by them, and they would send me over all these really great, colorful things where the ski scene at that time here in the United States, we're getting down to muted colors and earth tones and stuff. And I would come out with all these flashy, bright clothes. And I've had them since mid-80s, I guess, Jackson. And I started pulling them out again this year. I love it. People are going crazy. They're going, where'd you get that, man? And it's a 25-year-old ski suit that I had that is still fits.
I've still got some onesies from Descente, not quite as bright as ASICs, but in spirit, the same thing. There's a famous post review from K2 where you seem to be skiing on the last centimeter of your two skis that the bottom of the skis are coming right at the viewer. That's where a lot of Americans think you're supposed to ski powder. Everyone says, well, you sit back and powder, right? any actual good tips for powder skiers out there?
Okay, let's back up to that long poster that I did for K2. That was the first year K2 came out with a red, white, and blue base. And they wanted to feature the base of the ski. This was at Sun Valley after a competition we had there. And I went out with the photographer and he said, okay, Wayne, all we want you to do is just get up on the tails of the skis and so I can see the base of that, of the K2s. I said, okay, we can do that. So we shot that in March of 1972 at Sun Valley. And that became probably one of the most prominent ski posters around. The whole thing about sitting back, I don't do that all the time.
I mention it only because I think in the non-powder skiing public's mind, oh my God, all this snow. Obviously, the clever man solution is to sit back. But you and I both know that is not a winning proposition.
No, the misnomer about sitting back in powder is in actuality, the visual looks like you're sitting back. But what you're doing is tipping your axis in relationship to your skis. You're not letting your backside go behind your heels too far, but you're tipping your entire axis and helping the tips of the skis to rise up and start to plane. So that's the trick to it, is don't sit back because you'll get tired. With the fatter skis, it makes it that much easier. But the whole idea is to tip your body axis in relationship to your skis, trying to stay as perpendicular to the skis as possible to get the kit planing as opposed to submerging. Although sometimes it's nice to have the tips way down and you get those face shots and the snow comes up over your head because the skis are still down below and the snow is just rushing up over the skis and up over your chest and your head. That's a rush in itself.
That's huge fun. One of the signature characteristics of your skiing, and it really doesn't seem to change with terrain, because I've seen you do this in bumps and groomers and in powder, you finish a turn. You rinse the end of that turn. You drain every last bit of curvature out of that turn. The skis are completely across the fall line, yet there seems to be no deceleration, no change in velocity. It's like pouring mercury down the hill. any tips on how to finish a turn, which Americans are generally speaking terrible at, by the way? Any help to teach people how to finish a turn on edge and in the right position?
That's what I really, really enjoy, like you said, Jackson, squeezing every bit of energy out of the ski. People ski for different reasons. And for me, the feel of that ski arcing and the ski carving a turn and the ski bending and flexing and counterflexing, that's where I'm getting my joy. It's not so much the speed or going as straight and as fast as you can down the hill. I'm trying to utilize the terrain and make the skis one and myself one with the terrain and the skis and to make everything work in symmetry. And as a result, you know, I get this great feel of completing the turn and feel the entire ski engage from the tip all the way through the forefoot, under the foot, and all the way through the tail of the ski and feeling the pressure load and feeling the pressure release. And I think that's the big deal. A lot of people that don't complete a turn will only go through the tip engagement through the middle part and not really feel and load the tail of the ski. And that's where you get a lot of energy and a lot of snap out of the ski design itself to help move into the next turn. So that's why, for me, to be able to crank on that tail, that latter part, and I agree, it's sitting back. I am sitting back because I'm loading that tail as much as I possibly can to make it arc even further across the hill. But then I will move forward into the turn with the help of the ski unloading and moving me in, projecting me forward into the next turn. That's where the thrill for me is.
People have had the opportunity to learn these techniques from you in your own clinics. The Ski the Wong Way clinics have been going on for a long time. Tell us about the program, its history, when you started doing it, what students can expect to get out of your program. Tell us about Ski the Wong Way.
So Ski the Wong Way came back from like the first or second year that I was skiing, one of the ladies in this ski shop kept teasing me, "Oh, you're back here skiing the wrong way." And that kind of stuck with me from the early 60s. Down the road, you know, after my competitive career and everything else, I really wanted to focus a little bit more on the technical aspects of skiing. One of the things that I came up with was learn right from wrong or ski the wrong way, trying to teach people not necessarily through a structured PSI format, but more from my experience, what I've been able to feel and learn through my own skiing experience, to take a little bit of a different approach than a regimented technique or style, to teach people how to feel their skis and take away some of the misconceptions and illusions that are in skiing, to make it more fun and for them to understand how all that comes together for them. I've done many, many clinics all over the country and taking people out and showing them the different ways you can make a ski turn and really get more out of it than just trying to whip the skis back and forth. I continue to do that. And there's a lot of little tricks of the trade that the average skier looks at and tries to emulate it, but it's all wrong. So if you try to teach them that to get away from what they see is not necessarily what they should be doing is kind of what I try to teach people as well.
What's the most common problem you see in your clients?
So in skiing, good skiing, you do have to sit back. You have to load that tail of the ski. So in other words, you don't want to stay there. Because what happens, a lot of people will get onto the back and they'll stay there. And then their skis will accelerate and shoot out from underneath them. But once you get the feel of how much pressure to load that tail of the ski, then you move forward back onto the tip of your ski to make it the tip start to engage in the opposite direction. Sitting back is okay. Don't stay there. And then the other thing that I see all the time on the hill is people that have taken ski lessons, they say, face downhill, face downhill. My theory on that is you want to stay perpendicular to the direction of travel. What that means, if I'm skiing fall line straight down, point A to point B, straight down the fall line, yes, my shoulders are going to be square to that line. But if I'm making bigger radius, medium to large radius turns, then my shoulders are going to come off of the fall line and stay squarer to my direction of travel. The reason I do that is because if you stay square, then your feet and your skis have a lot more room to rotate. But if you lock yourself up with your shoulders locked to facing downhill, you've locked your hips up and you've locked your feet and ankles up and you can't turn anymore. So by squaring off a little bit more, you can allow the skis to stay underneath you and actually turn a little bit more easily than trying to keep everything facing down the fall line. You don't have to do that.
When and where is the next session?
Well, I'm actually looking at maybe doing some stuff at Deer Valley this winter. I'm talking with him right now as we speak. Hopefully, we'll be able to do something there. And I will post stuff on my Wayne Wong Facebook page as we get a little closer to that.
By the way, dear listeners, if you've never been there, Deer Valley is a great place to learn technique. A lot of the trails are non-threatening, so you can focus on what you're doing, and the grooming is unparalleled.
Yeah, it's spectacular. And then this winter, they've announced that they're expanding Deer Valley. They're adapting to the Mayflower development, which is on the northeast side of Deer Valley by the gondola side. And they'll add on, I think, about another 1,500 acres. It will be the following season, the season of 24-25, I believe, where they'll actually have lifts operating on that new expansion. But the runs are already cut there. They're just announced that they're going to be taking over that whole project for next winter.
Sounds fantastic. Let's go back to a shared time that you and I had together. I think it was about 1991 that the great John Fry, the editor at Snow Country, gave me the go-ahead to hire a 5-star test team. He didn't have to ask me twice. Actually, it was more like a 25-star test team, of which you were an integral part. I have a great photo of you and Tamara playfully chasing each other down Alpine Meadows where we would convene. I ran a ski test, ladies and gentlemen, for 3 weeks. Most ski tests run for 4 days. 3 weeks. And we segregated all the photo taking away from all the ski testing, so it never got in the way of the ski test. Any fond memories you can share?
You know, again, Jackson, thank you for having me part of that team. It was a great experience. Again, like way back in the early 70s when I was with skiing and was able to test all the new skis for next year. And then, you know, with you in Snow Country, be able to, again, get back out and see what all the manufacturers are putting out there for the consumer. And I think one of the most significant things is that when we were ski testing, that was when the transition came from our straight conventional skis to the shape ski, parabolics, or whatever you want to call them at that time. I know that I kind of poo-hooed that whole thing. I didn't get it. I didn't understand what this whole shape ski, the deep side cut, what the parabolic shape was all about. And we tried to ski those skis like we were skiing our 200s, 210 straight conventional ski with very little side cut. And then all of a sudden, the light clicked. I was skiing with one of the other testers, Mike Croak. I saw him tip the ski over and engage, and I watched him arc across the hill. And I go, holy moly, that's what it's all about. And at that moment, my life changed. My whole skiing thing changed. I go, that's what we've been trying to figure out, how to use the side cut of the ski and how much easier it is now with the design. From that point on, I think, you know, we were skiing on the Kneisels and the Elans. Once I got that figured out, man, I just started arcing. And I haven't looked back and I go, wow, it gave me a whole new breath of life in the skiing, because now all of a sudden my technique has changed again. I'm realizing that this is almost a whole new ball game to get the skis to get out there and use the side cut and really get these skis to arc. And I go, this is so much fun. And I started really getting into this over the next year. And I just felt bad for people who were still struggling on a conventional ski. For me, I was just tipping the ski over sideways and let the side cut engage and make these great arcing turns and holding in the turn and not slipping or not sliding. And I watched people struggle for years. And I guess they kind of poo-hooed the shape ski thing for many, many years, like I did right at the very start of it. And I didn't realize, but then I got a slap in the face and go, wow, this is what it's all about. For me, ski testing with you guys was this realization that technology, the technological changes during that time frame was incredible. Really a big step for skiing.
It was a transformative period. The wide ski also began at the beginning of that decade and would come also to dominate design along with shape, interestingly enough. Another thing you and I did together, actually it was all you, just handed me a microphone so that I could help. It was the Wayne Wong World Hot Dog Skiing Championships at Alpine Meadows. It was a fundraiser for juvenile diabetes. We had sit-down dinner for filling a casino ballroom in Reno. I think it ran for 3 years. One of my co-judges was Principal Belding of Saved by the Bell, Dennis Haskell. The yeah. other was a local celebrity here, Curtis Fong. It was a party at your house afterwards, after the first one, I think. There must have been 10 world championships represented around that room. I think Blake did a backflip with another skier on the same pair of skis, double-mounted skis, I think, at one point.
So the whole concept with the Wayne Wong World Hot Dog Skiing Championships was just a fun event for not only the competitors, for spectators, because I think in the early days of freestyle, it was so exciting. It was so much fun. And then it just got kind of, diluted. And I wanted to bring that spirit back, that feeling back. And so I invited all my fellow competitors that I competed with and also a bunch of the new school guys to come and compete, but not serious competition, but more fun and the camaraderie and to get the feel back that we all had back in the early day. One of the things that was mandatory was you had to do a slow dog noodle somewhere in your routine. And the slow dog noodle is just getting on the backside of a mogul, sitting way back, holding that pivot as long as you could and pivot and go and stand back up and ski off. That was the only main criteria you had. And that's what kind of made it fun. But Plake took it to the next level. He mounted up a pair of skis for dual skiers. So they skied the bumps, the top part of the bump, the run again, the yellow run, and paired up. And then they started to do spins and 360s and stuff as a tandem team down through the finish area. Again, that added that element of fun and excitement back into it. So it's, you know, not so darn serious where everybody's trying to beat the other guy. That wasn't my whole idea. My whole idea was just to come out, have fun, show people what can be done, how much fun you can have on skis. I think we accomplished that while we raised a bunch of money for juvenile diabetes.
I remember Clendenin throwing a handful of single dollar bills at the judges at my encouragement, of course.
See, there you go. Now, did that buy him a couple extra points?
Oh, I think so. We were pretty generous in our scoring, except when we weren't. But we sure had a lot of fun. Another thing that your fans might not even know about is you had a signature ski. It wasn't made by K2. It was a very sort of futuristic carving focused device called the Anton Glider, but it also was at one point called the Wayne Wong, or the, how was it titled?
Okay. Back in the early days, doing promotions with K2, my friend Yoshi Nakagawa, who ran ONU Sports in Seattle, did a private label ski with my name out with K2 called the Wong Banger skis. And that was a specialty ski for his stores in the Seattle area. About 15 years ago, I've been waiting to see what the new technology would bring to ski manufacturers, because we went through the shape ski, we went through carving skis, went through the fat skis. I was really wanting to see what the next level would be. And I met this guy named Anton Wilson out of New York, who's an engineer. And he came up with this idea of putting a suspension system on top of the ski, which was made by two springs, like hunting bow springs on the tip and the tail, which pushed the tip and the tail down independently, which allowed the ski to be pressured all the time. So it allowed you to balance it more easier. The skis were already engaged. So it was a simplicity thing of just rolling the ski up on edge. So your forward and aft movements were minimal now, much less than in other skis. So by tipping the ski over and it was loading via these springs, the tip and the tail, you could allow the ski to take its arc in the turn. When I first skied on them, after the third turn, I called Anton back and I said, "Anton, I think you've done it. We got to talk. I think you really do what ski engineers have been trying to do, how to dampen a ski, take the vibration out of ski, and make the ski more forgiving in that respect." Because this system is all hand-built, all hand-engineered, it got very costly. We approached a company like K2, and they said, "Wayne, you know what? This works exactly like you said. Unfortunately, at this point, our marketing strategy is on the fatter, wider skis." It's not saying that the system doesn't work. It's just the timing wasn't right. And I got it. A couple of years later, about 7 or 8 years ago, I met a guy that also worked with Anton. And we decided to take the Anton system a little bit farther. And we produced 40 pairs of skis as a demo. And it was called the Legend Ski. It's the Wayne Wong Signature Series. What we did is we took the Anton design, but we modified it a little bit. So it wasn't quite as aggressive. It was a little bit easier to ski on for the general public. Again, because the ski is always handmade and all engineered, it got too costly to actually produce as a commercial aspect. Unfortunately, people are asking, where can I get them? I said, unfortunately, we only built 40 pairs. And we built like a 155, a 165, 175, and a 185. The ski that I ski on day to day is the 155 with about a 14-meter radius. It just arcs all over the place. And man, at Deer Valley, you can't catch me, man.
Oh, you're still obviously an active skier. What's a typical Wayne Wong ski day look like?
Funny you should ask, Jackson. I'm getting on in age. I hate to tell you, I'm not a youngster anymore, but it's all about quality skiing for me now, not necessarily quantity. You know, back in the day, I'd be on the lift at first lift, 8 o'clock or 8:30, and be the last one off the mountain. But nowadays, with the technology and the high speed lifts, you get as much skiing as you possibly could want in a day easily. So my day would be to go out and get a couple of great runs when it's fresh snow, fresh groom, and go and have a nice lunch, and then go back out, make a few more runs till about 3 o'clock, 3:30, go in for a glass of wine.
That's still a pretty full day, my man. By the way, you and I are the same age, so I'm in there with you side by side. You alluded to something a moment ago, a note that I want to end on. In the early days of freestyle, sure, we were competing, but we also felt a spirit of community. We cheered each other on. We didn't do things like they do in baseball where they try to cheat. You tried to do the best you could, have a great time, and party at the end of the day. It wasn't the same attitude that you had in the sort of cutthroat racing environment. And I think one of the reasons that your popularity endures is because you embody that spirit. I've been so glad to have you on my podcast, Wayne. And I'm so glad that you're still rocking the free world.
Thanks, Jackson. Yeah, I really appreciate it having me on your show. And look for me, you know, whether we're going to be in Tahoe, I'll be up in Tahoe, down to Mammoth, Deer Valley. I'm hoping to go back to Waterville Valley again this winter. They're hosting a World Cup freestyle event there. So I'm hoping to go back and be part of that whole thing. But I'll be out there skiing the long way.
You'll be able to spot him, folks. He'll be in the bright ASIC suit and the white Frank sunglasses. Thanks again, Wayne. Look forward to seeing you on the hill.
All right. Thank you, Jackson. Appreciate it.
And I appreciate you, my dear listeners, for catching this episode of Real Skiers with Jackson Hogan. Thanks for listening.